of these people make it that far? And why was the cause of this great movement of people not reported in Britain? She had never heard of anything like it. Did the press and the politicians think that it would have no effect on her country? Where were these desperate people hoping to get to, anyway? She mustn't ask, mustn't show any interest at all. Her only hope of getting to the City of the Demons and finding Pan was to hold her tongue and restrain every instinct of curiosity. So she watched as the newcomers gathered their possessions and slowly dispersed. Perhaps they'd make for the port. Perhaps they'd find a shelter in one of the camps. They might have a little more money than the people she'd seen shipwrecked, which had allowed them to take the train. They might find somewhere affordable to lodge. Before very long, they had all left the station, and then Lyra found the platform getting busier with people from Smyrna itself, commuting home after their day's work. When the Seleukia train came in, it filled up quickly with these commuters. She realized that if she wanted a seat, she'd better move quickly, and hurried to get on board, and found one, just in time. It was a corner seat. She made herself small and insignificant. The first person to sit next to her was a heavy man in a Homburg hat, who looked at her curiously as he set his bulging briefcase down beside him. It was only when his mongoose demon whispered in his ear, curling herself around his neck and peering myopically at Lyra, that he realized that something was wrong. He said something sharply in Turkish.
"Pardon," Lyra murmured, sticking to French. "Excusez-moi."
If she had been a child, her demon would be a puppy, abjectly wagging his tail and trying to appease this big, important, powerful man. That was the mood she tried to project. He wasn't happy about it, but as the only result of moving away from her would be that he'd have to stand, he remained in his seat and turned away in extravagant distaste. No one else seemed to notice, or else they were all too tired to care. The train steamed slowly from one suburban station to the next, and then out of the city and through a series of country towns and villages, the carriage gradually emptying as it went. The heavy man with the bulging briefcase said something as he stood up to leave, half to her, half to the other people nearby, but again, no one took any notice. After an hour or so, the towns and villages thinned out, and the train gathered speed a little. The evening was advancing. The sun had vanished behind the mountains. The temperature in the compartment was falling, and when the conductor came through to inspect tickets, he first had to light the gas lamps before he could see. The carriage consisted of a number of separate compartments linked by a corridor along one side. In Lyra's compartment, once the commuters had all got off, there were three other travellers, and in the new light of the gas lamp, she studied them without looking directly. There was a woman in her 30s, with a pale and sickly-looking child of 6 or so, and an elderly man with a moustache and heavy-lidded eyes, wearing an immaculate light grey suit and a red fez. His demon was a small and elegant ferret. The man was reading an Anatolian newspaper, but not long after the conductor had lit the lamp, he folded the paper with great care and set it on the seat between himself and Lyra. The little boy was watching him solemnly, thumb in mouth, head leaning against his mother's shoulder. When the old man folded his hands in his lap and closed his eyes, the child turned to stare at Lyra, sleepy, puzzled, troubled. His mouse demon kept up a whispering conversation with the mother's pigeon demon, the two of them flicking glances at Lyra and looking away again. The woman herself was thin, drawn, poorly dressed, and seemed worn down by anxiety. They had one small suitcase, battered and clumsily repaired on the rack above them. Time went past. The daylight vanished, and the world outside the compartment narrowed to the reflection of the little space itself in the window. Lyra began to feel hungry, and opened the bag of honey cakes she'd bought on the station. Seeing the child gazing at them with obvious desire, she held out the bag to him, and then to his mother, who flinched as if in fear. But they were both hungry, and when Lyra smiled and gestured to say, "Please, take one," first the little boy, and then his mother slowly reached in and took one out. The woman murmured a phrase of thanks almost too quietly to be heard, and nudged the boy, who whispered the same words.
They ate the honey cakes at once, and it was clear to Lyra that it was the first food they'd had for some time. The elderly man had opened his eyes, and he was watching the little transaction with serious and considered approval. Lyra held out the bag to him, and after a brief interval of surprise, he took a cake and unfolded a snow-white handkerchief and laid it across his lap. He said to Lyra a sentence or two in Anatolian, obviously in appreciation, but all she could do in response was to say, "Excusez-moi, monsieur, mais je ne parle pas votre langue." He inclined his head, smiled with dignified courtesy, and ate the cake in several small bites.
"That was a most delicious honey cake," he said in French. "Very kind of you."
There were two left in the bag. Lyra was still hungry, but she had some bread and cheese, too, so she offered the cakes to the mother and her child. The boy was keen, but anxious, and the woman at first tried to refuse. But Lyra said in French,
"Please, take them. I bought far too many for myself. Please do."
The man translated her words, and finally the woman nodded, and let the boy have one, but she wouldn't take the last for herself. The man had an attaché case of brown leather, and he opened it and took out a vacuum flask. It was the sort that had two cups as part of the top, and he unscrewed them both and set them on the case next to him, where his ferret demon held them steady as he filled them with hot coffee. He offered the first cup to the mother, who refused, though she seemed to want it, and then to the child, who shook his head doubtful, and then to Lyra, who took it gratefully. It was intensely sweet. And that reminded her of the bottle of carbonated orange drink that she'd bought at the station. She found it and offered it to the child. He smiled, but looked up to his mother, who smiled too and nodded her thanks, and Lyra unscrewed the top and handed it to him.
"Are you travelling a long way, mademoiselle?" the old man said. His French was flawless.
"A very long way," Lyra said, "but on this train, only to Seleukia."
"Do you know that city?"
"No, I shan't be there long."
"Perhaps that would be wise. I understand that civil order is somewhat disturbed there. You are not French, I think, mademoiselle?"
"You're right. I come from further north."
"You are travelling a long way from your homeland."
"Yes, I am. But it's a journey I have to make.
I hesitate to ask, and if I am being impolite, I most sincerely beg your pardon, but it seems to me that you are one of the women of the far north, those known as the witches."
He used the word sorcière. Lyra, intensely wary, looked at him directly, but could see only courteous interest.
"That is true, monsieur," she said. "I admire your courage in coming so readily among the lands of the south. I am emboldened to speak like this, because I travelled a great deal myself at one time, and many years ago I was so lucky as to fall in love with a witch from the far north. We were very happy, and I was very young."
"Such encounters do happen," she said. "But in the nature of things, they cannot last.
Nevertheless, I learned a good deal. I learned a certain amount about myself, which was, no doubt, useful. My witch, if I may call her that, came from Sakhalin, in the far east of Russia. May I know the name of your homeland?"
"In Russian, it's called Novikievsk. We have our own name, which I'm not allowed to pronounce away from there. It's a small island, and we love it fiercely."
"May I ask, what has brought you to travel among us?"
"The queen of my clan has fallen sick, and the only cure for her disease is a plant that grows near the Caspian Sea. Perhaps you were wondering why I am not flying there. The fact is that I was attacked in St. Petersburg, and my cloud pine was burnt. My demon flew home to tell my sisters what had happened, and I am travelling like this across the earth, slowly."
"I see," he said. "I hope your journey is successful, and that you return with the cure for your queen's malady.
That is kind of you, monsieur. Are you travelling to the end of this line?
Merely as far as Antalya. My home is there. I am retired, but I still retain an interest in some business affairs in Smyrna.
The child had been watching them with a sort of exhaustion that is beyond sleep.
Lyra realized that he was ill. How had she not seen that before?
His face was pale and gaunt, the skin around his eyes dark and drawn. He needed to sleep more than anything else in the world, but his body wouldn't let him. He still held the half-empty bottle of orange drink, and his mother took it from his limp fingers and screwed the top on. The old man said,
"I am going to tell this little fellow a story."
He reached into an inner pocket of his silk jacket and took out a pack of cards. They were narrower than ordinary playing cards, and when he laid one down on the attaché case on his knees, facing the child, Lyra saw that it showed a picture of a landscape. Something jogged her memory, and she was back in that smoky cellar in Prague, with the magician telling her about cards and pictures. The card showed a road running from one side to the other, and beyond the road a stretch of open water, a river or a lake, with a sailing boat on it. Beyond the water was part of an island, where a castle stood on a wooded hill. On the road, two soldiers in scarlet uniforms were riding splendid horses. The old man began to speak, describing the scene or naming the soldiers or explaining where they were going. The little boy, leaning into his mother's side, watched with those exhausted eyes. The man laid another picture card next to the first. The two landscapes fitted together perfectly. The road moved on, and on this card a path led away towards a house standing among trees at the edge of the water. Evidently the soldiers turned off the road and went to knock at the door of the house, where a farmer's wife gave them some water from the well beside the path. As he mentioned each event, each little object, the old man touched a silver pencil to the card, precisely showing where it was. The little boy peered closer, blinking, as if he found it hard to see. Then the old man spread out the rest of the cards in his hands, face down, and offered them to the boy, asking him to take one. He did, and the old man laid it next to the last. As before, the picture seamlessly continued the landscape of the previous one, and Lyra saw that the whole pack must be like that, and it must be possible to put them together in an uncountable number of ways. This time, the picture showed a ruined tower, with the road running across as ever in front of it, and the lake continuing behind. The soldiers were tired, so they went into the tower and tied up their horses before lying down to sleep. But flying over the tower was a large bird. There it was, a gigantic bird, a bird so huge that it flew down and seized one of the horses in each claw and took them up into the sky. So Lyra judged to be what was happening, from the way the old man mimed the bird's flight and uttered the terrified neighing of the captured horses. Even the mother was listening closely, wide-eyed like her son. The soldiers woke up. One was about to fire his rifle at the bird, but the other held him back because the horses would certainly die if the bird dropped them. So they set off on foot to follow the bird. And the story went on. Lyra leaned back, attending to the old man's voice without understanding it, but happy to guess and watch the expressions come and go on the faces of the boy and his mother and gradually enliven them both, bringing a flush of warmth to their sallow cheeks, brightening their eyes. The old man's voice was melodious and comforting. Lyra found herself slipping backwards into slumber, into the easy sleep of her childhood, with Alice's voice, not so musical but soft and low, telling her a story about this doll or that picture, as her eyes fell heavily, softly closed. When she woke up, it was some hours later. She was alone in the compartment, and the train was steaming steadily up a gradient among mountains, as she could see through the window, a starlit panorama of bleak rocks and cliffs and ravines. After a moment's slow confusion, she suddenly thought, "The alethiometer! She flung open her rucksack, plunged a hand inside, and found the familiar, heavy roundness in its velvet bag. But there was something else, on her lap. A little pasteboard box with a bright label saying, Miriorama. It was the old man's pack of picture cards. He had left it for her. The light from the gas lamp was inconstant, flaring briefly before sinking to a faint flicker, and then rising again. Lyra stood up and looked at it closely, but there was no means of turning it up or down. There must be a problem with the supply. She sat down again and took out the cards, and in one of the flares of light, she noticed something. Some words written on the back of one of the cards, in an elegant hand in pencil. They were in French.
Dear young lady, please take my advice, and be very careful when you reach Seleucia. These are difficult times. It would be best if you did not even cast a shadow. With my most earnest wishes for your well-being.
It wasn't signed, but she remembered the silver pencil he'd been using to point out details in the pictures. She sat there, troubled and lonely in the inconstant gaslight, unable to sleep any more. She found her bread and cheese and ate a little, thinking it might strengthen her. Then she took out Malcolm's last letter and reread it, but it brought her little comfort. She put it back and reached for the alethiometer again. She wasn't intending to read it or to use the new method, just to hold something familiar and be comforted by it. The light was too poor to see the symbols clearly in any case. She held the instrument on her lap and thought about the new method. All the time, she was trying to resist the temptation to try it there and then. She would look for Malcolm, of course, but with no idea where to start, and it would be fruitless and leave her sickened and weak, so she shouldn't do it. And anyway, what was she thinking of? Intending to look for Malcolm. It was Pan she should look for. She gathered the little cards together with an automatic hand. That was the phrase that came to her, as if her hand were purely mechanical, not alive at all, as if the messages from her skin and her nerves were changes in the amberic current along a copper wire, not anything conscious. With that vision of her body as something dead and mechanical came a sense of limitless desolation. She felt not only as if she were dead now, but that she'd always been dead, and had only dreamed of being alive. And that there was no life in the dream, either. It was only the meaningless and indifferent jostling of particles in her brain. Nothing more. But that little chain of ideas provoked a spasm of reaction, and she thought, "No! That's a lie! That's a slander! I don't believe it!" Except that she did believe it just then, and it was killing her. She made a helpless movement with her hands, her automatic hands, which disturbed the little cards in her lap and sent some of them falling to the floor of the carriage. She leaned down to pick them up. The first one she found showed a woman, alone, crossing a bridge. She was carrying a basket and was herself wrapped up in a shawl against a cold day. She was looking out of the picture as if directly at Lyra, who saw her with a little jar of self-recognition. She set the card down on the dusty seat beside her, and picked up another at random, and set it beside the first. This one showed a number of travellers walking along beside some pack horses. They were going in the same direction as the woman, from left to right, and the bundles on the animals' backs were large and heavy-looking. Make them camels instead of horses. Sweep away the trees and replace them with a sandy desert, and they could be a camel train on the Silk Road. As faintly as a bell tolling just once a mile away on a summer evening, as tenuous as the fragrance of a single flower born indoors through an open window, there came to Lyra the notion that the secret commonwealth was involved in this. She picked up one more card. It was one of those the old man had come to in his story, the one with the farmhouse and the well among the trees. She saw what she hadn't seen before. There were roses growing over an archway outside the door. She thought, "I could choose to believe in the secret commonwealth. I don't have to be skeptical about it. If free will exists, and I have it,
I can choose that. I'll try one more. She shuffled the cards and then cut them and turned over the one on the top. She laid it next to the last. It showed a young man, a knapsack on his back, walking towards the pack horses and the woman with the basket. To the uninflected eye, he probably looked no more like Malcolm than the woman with the basket resembled her, but that didn't matter. The train began to slow down. The whistle blew, and a lonely sound it made, which Lyra seemed to hear echoing among the mountains. There was a French poem she used to know, about a horn blowing in a forest. There were isolated lights on the slopes, and then more lights, lit buildings and streets. They were coming into a station. Lyra gathered all the cards together and put them with the alethiometer in her rucksack. The train came to a halt. The name of the station, painted on a board, was not one she recognized. At all events, it wasn't Seleucia. And it didn't seem to be a large place. But the platform was crowded. It was packed with soldiers. She moved further into the corner and held her rucksack on her lap. Chapter 29. News from Tashbulak. The message brought to Glenys Godwin by the Cabinet Office messenger was brief and to the point. The Chancellor of the Private Purse would be obliged if Mrs. Godwin would attend on him this morning at 10:20. It was signed with what looked like a contemptuous and indecipherable scribble, in which Godwin recognized the signature of the Chancellor, Elliot Newman. It arrived at her Oakley Street office at 9:30, giving her enough time to cross London to the Chancellor's office in Whitehall, but not enough to consult her colleagues, or do very much more than to say to her secretary, "Jill, the time's come. They're going to close us down. Tell all the heads of section that Christabel is now in operation." Christabel was the name for a long-standing plan to withdraw and conceal the most important of all the active papers. Christabel's status was constantly reviewed, and only the section heads were aware of it. If the word got around as quickly as it could, the papers concerning the bulk of Oakley Street's current projects would be on their way to various locations, these to a locked room behind a laundry in Pimlico, those to the safe of a diamond merchant in Hatton Garden, others to a cupboard in the vestry of a church in Hemel Hempstead, by the time Godwin entered the office in Whitehall to which she'd been summoned. The assistant private secretary who met her at the door was so young he could hardly have been shaving for more than a year, she thought, and he regarded her with exquisitely polite condescension. But she treated this junior functionary like a favourite nephew, and even managed to extract a little information from him about what she could expect.
"Frankly, Mrs. Godwin, it's all arisen from the forthcoming visit of the new president of the High Council of the Magisterium. But of course, I didn't tell you that," the young man said.
"A wise person knows when to keep things dark. An even wiser person knows when to let the light in," Glenys Godwin said gravely as they climbed the stairs. It was the first she'd heard about Delamere visiting London. The assistant private secretary was duly impressed by his own wisdom, and showed her into the outer office before softly knocking at the inner door and announcing the visitor in deferential tones. Elliot Newman, the Chancellor of the Private Purse, was a large man with slick black hair and heavy black-rimmed spectacles, whose demon was a black rabbit. He had been in office less than a year. Glenys Godwin had met him only once, and had had to listen to a lengthy and ignorant explanation of why Oakley Street was useless, expensive, and counter-modern, that being the latest way of describing anything His Majesty's government did not like. Newman didn't stand up to greet his visitor, and didn't offer to shake her hand. It was precisely as she had expected.
"This little department of yours, what do you call it?
The Chancellor knew perfectly well, but he picked up a paper and peered down at it as if to remind himself of the name.
"The Intelligence Division of the Office of the Private Purse," he read fastidiously.
He sat back, as if he'd finished a sentence. Since he hadn't, Godwin said nothing and continued to look at him mildly.
Well? Said Newman. Every tone of his voice was designed to express barely controlled impatience.
Yes. That's the full name of the department.
We're closing it down. It's disrecognized. It's an anomaly. Counter-modern. A useless money pit. Besides which, the political tendency is iniquitous.
You'll have to explain what you mean by that, Chancellor.
It expresses a hostility to the new world we're in. There are new ways of doing things, new ideas, new men in charge.
You mean the new High Council in Geneva, I take it?
Yes, I do. Of course I do. Forward-looking, not bound by convention and propriety. HMG is of the opinion that that's where the future lies. It's the correct way to go. We must reach out the hand of friendship to the future, Mrs. Godwin. All the old ways, the suspicions, the plotting, the spying, the gathering of endless pages of useless and irrelevant so-called information must come to an end. And that very much includes the ramshackle outfit you've been battening onto for years past. Now, we're not going to treat you badly. Staff will all be reassigned positions in the domestic civil service. You'll have a decent pension and some sort of bauble, if that's what you fancy. Except with good grace, and no one will be any the worse. In a year or two, Oakley Street, yes, I know what you call yourselves, Oakley Street will have vanished forever. Not a trace left.
I see.
A team from the Cabinet Office will come over this afternoon to begin the transition. You'll be dealing with Robin Prescott, first-class man. You'll hand over everything to him and be out of your office and home pruning the roses by the weekend. Prescott will deal with all the details.
Godwin said, "Very well, Chancellor. The authority for this comes entirely from this office, I take it?"
"What do you mean?" "You represented it as a move towards modernity and away from the habits of the past."
"That's right."
"And that turn towards streamlined efficiency is strongly identified with you in the public mind?"
"I'm pleased to say it is," said the Chancellor, a little suspicion creeping into his manner.
"Why?"
"Because unless you manage the announcement with some caution, it will look like appeasement."
"Appeasing who, for God's sake?" "Appeasing the High Council. I gather the new president is visiting soon.
To do away with the very body that's done more than any other branch of government to curb Geneva's influence on our affairs would look to those who know about these things like an act of extraordinary generosity, if not actually abject self-damage."
Newman's face had darkened to a dull crimson. "Get out, and put your affairs in order," he said.
Godwin nodded and turned to go. The assistant private secretary opened the door for her, and accompanied her down the marble stairs to the entrance, seeming all the way to be on the point of saying something, and not to be able to find the words. As they reached the great mahogany doors that opened onto Whitehall, the young man finally found something to say.
Could I perhaps call a taxi for you, Mrs. Godwin?"
"Kind of you, but I think I'll walk part of the way," she said, and shook the young man's hand.
"I wouldn't tie yourself too closely to the office of the private purse, if I were you," she added.
"Really?"
"Your chief is cutting off the branch he's sitting on, and he'll take the whole office down with him. That's an educated guess. Cultivate some alternative sources of power. Always a wise precaution. Good day."
She left, and walked up Whitehall a little way, before turning into the War Office, and asking a porter to take a message to Mr. Carberry. She wrote a few lines on one of her cards, and handed it to the man before leaving and making her way down to the gardens on the embankment that faced the river. It was a clear, bright day, with big, dazzling clouds moving busily across the sky, and the air felt almost sparkling.
Glenys found a bench near the statue of some long-dead statesman and sat down to enjoy the river. The tide was high. A string of barges pulled by a sturdy little tug was moving upstream, carrying a cargo of coal.
"What will we do?"
said her demon.
"Oh, we'll flourish. It'll be like the old days."
"Or when we were young and full of energy?"
"We're wilier now."
"Slower?"
"Cleverer."
"More easily damaged?"
"Well, we'll have to put up with that. Here's Martin."
Martin Carberry was a permanent secretary at the War Office and an old friend of Oakley Street. Glenys stood up to greet him, and by unspoken agreement and long habit, they began to stroll along together to talk.
"Can't stay long," Carberry said, "meeting with the Muscovite naval attaché at 12. What's up?"
"They're closing us down. I've just been with Newman. Apparently we're counter-modern. Of course we'll survive, but we'll have to go a little undergroundish. What I want to know now, quite urgently, is what the new High Council in Geneva is up to. I gather the chief man's coming here in a couple of days."
"Apparently so. There's talk of a memorandum of understanding, which will change the way we work with them. What they're up to? Well, they're assembling a large strike force in Eastern Europe. That's what the Muscovite chap's coming here to talk about, not surprisingly. There's been a lot of diplomatic activity in the Levant, Persia too, and further east. We've been aware of that, but our own resources are stretched, as you can imagine. If you had to put a fiver on it, what would you say this strike force was being set up to do?"
"To invade Central Asia. There's talk of a source of valuable chemicals or minerals or something in a desert in the middle of some howling wilderness, and it's a matter of strategic importance for the Magisterium not to let anyone else get at it before they do. There's a very strong commercial interest as well, pharmaceuticals mainly. It's all a bit blurred, to tell you the truth. Reports rely too much on rumour or gossip or old wives' tales. Our interest, at the moment, lies in keeping the peace with Geneva. We haven't yet been asked to contribute the brigade of guards, or even some second-hand water cannons, but no doubt we'd regard it favourably if we were."
"They can't invade anywhere without an excuse. What'll it be, do you think?"
"That's what all the diplomacy's about. I heard that there is, or was, some sort of science place, a research institute or something, at the edge of the desert concerned. There were scientists from various countries working there, including ours, and they've been under pressure from local fanatics, of whom there are not a few. And the casus belli will probably be a confected sense of outrage that innocent scholars have been brutally treated by bandits or terrorists, and the Magisterium's natural desire to rescue them."
"What are the local politics?"
"Confused. The desert and the moving lake."
"A moving lake?"
"It's called Lop Nor. Really an immense area of salt marshes and shallow lakes where earth movements and changes in the climate play old Harry with the geography. Anyway, national borders are flexible, or changeable, or negotiable. There is a king who claims to rule there, but he's really a vassal of the Empire of Cathay, which is as much as to say that it depends on the current state of the Emperor's health whether Peking feels like exercising power or not."
"What's Oakley Street's interest in this?"
"There's something going on there, and we need to know about it. Now that we've been officially disrecognized..."
"Lovely word.
A coinage of Newman's, I think. Anyway, now we've ceased to exist, I want to cover as many angles as I can reach while I still can."
"Of course. But you've got a contingency plan. You must have seen this coming."
"Oh, yes. This just adds another layer of difficulty. But this government will fall in the end."
"Very sanguine. Glenys, if I need to contact you at any point..."
"A note Shay Isabel will always find me."
"Right. Well, good luck."
They shook hands and parted.
Isabel was an elderly woman who had been an agent herself until arthritis had forced her to retire. She now ran a restaurant in Soho, often used as an informal post office by people in the trade of intelligence. Glenys walked on along the embankment. There was a tourist boat moving slowly past, with a loudspeakered voice pointing out the sights. The sun shone on the river, on the arches of Waterloo Bridge, on the distant dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. Carberry had confirmed much of what she'd already suspected. The magisterium, under its new president, was intent on capturing and possessing the source of this rose oil, and was willing to muster an army and take it several thousand miles to do so. Anyone who was in the way could expect to be crushed without mercy.
"Pharmaceuticals," said Godwin.
"Thuringia potash," said her demon.
"Must be.
They're enormous."
"Well, Polstead will know what to do," said Godwin. And anyone who didn't know her would have heard nothing in her voice but boundless confidence and certainty. The doorman at the new Danish consulate in Smyrna said,
"Mr. Schlesinger is busy. He cannot see you now."
Malcolm knew the procedure. He took a small denomination banknote from his pocket and picked up a paperclip from the desk. "And this is my card," he said. He clipped the card to the banknote, which vanished at once into the doorman's pocket.
2 minutes, sir," the man said, and set off up the stairs.
It was a tall building on a narrow street near the ancient bazaar. Malcolm had been here twice before, but this was a new doorman, and something about the district had changed. People were watchful now. An air of casual well-being had vanished. The cafes were largely empty. He heard footsteps on the stairs and turned to greet the consul, but Bud shook his head, set his finger to his lips, and came down to meet him. A warm handshake, and Schlesinger nodded towards the door.
"Not safe," said Malcolm quietly as they walked along the street. "Listening wires everywhere. How are you, Mel?" "Fine. But you look a wreck. What's been happening?" "The apartment was firebombed." "No. Is Anita all right?" "Got out just in time. But she lost a lot of work and, well, there's not much left. You found Lyra yet? Have you seen her?"
Schlesinger told him how he'd first seen Lyra in the cafe and recognized her from the photogram.
"Anita helped her change her appearance a little, but she went out before the place was bombed, and we never saw her again. I say we never did, but I've asked around, and it seems she went to a nearby cafe and read a letter, which would have been the one from you that I passed on, and then went to the railroad station and caught a train towards the east, but not the fast Aleppo train, one that stops everywhere and crawls to, I think Seleukia is the final stop, near the border. That's the last I've managed to find out." "And she still hadn't found her demon?" "No. She had this idea he was in one of the dead towns outside Aleppo. But listen, Malcolm, something else has just come up. This is urgent. I'm going to take you to see a man called Ted Cartwright, just up here."
Malcolm was aware that Bud was checking in all directions, and he did the same, seeing no one. Schlesinger turned into an alley and unlocked a shabby green door. When they were inside, he locked it again and said,
"He's in poor shape, and I don't think he's got long. Up the stairs."
As Malcolm followed, he tried to place the name Ted Cartwright. He knew he'd heard it before. Someone had spoken it, in a Swedish accent, and there'd been a penciled scrawl on tattered paper.
Then he had it. "Tashbilak," he said, "the director of the research station." "Yep, he arrived yesterday, after God knows what sort of journey. This is a safe house, and we've arranged a nurse and a stenographer, but you need to hear it from his own lips. Here we are."
Another door, another lock, and they were inside a small, neat studio flat. A young woman in a dark blue uniform was taking the temperature of a man lying on the single bed. He was covered in nothing but a sheet. His eyes were closed, and he was sweating and emaciated, and his face was blistered with sunburn. His thrush demon clung to the padded headboard, dusty and weary. Asta jumped up beside her, and they whispered together.
"Is he any better?" asked Bud quietly.
The nurse shook her head.
"Dr. Cartwright?" said Malcolm.
The man opened his eyes, which were red-rimmed and bloodshot. They flickered constantly without focusing on anything, and Malcolm wasn't sure if Cartwright could see him at all. The nurse put her thermometer away, made a note on a chart, and stood up to let Malcolm have her chair. She went across to a table where boxes of pills and other medical supplies were neatly stacked. Malcolm sat down and said, "Dr. Cartwright, I'm a friend of your colleague, Lucy Arnold, in Oxford. My name is Malcolm Polstead. Can you hear me clearly?"
"Yes,"
came in a hoarse whisper.
"Can't see much, though."
"You're the director of the research station at Tashbilak?"
"Was. Destroyed now. Had to escape."
"Can you tell me about your colleagues, Dr. Strauss and Roderick Hassel?" A deep sigh, ending in a shuddering moan. Then Cartwright took another breath and said,
"Did he get back, Hassel?"
"Yes, with his notes. They were immensely helpful. What was this place they were investigating? The Red Building?"
"No idea. It was where the roses came from. They insisted on going into the desert. I shouldn't have let them. But they were desperate. We were all desperate. The men from the mountains. Shortly after, I sent Hassel home. Simurgh."
His voice faded. From behind him, Schlesinger whispered to Malcolm,
"What was that last word?"
"I'll tell you in a minute. Dr. Cartwright, are you still awake?"
"The men from the mountains. They had modern arms."
"What sort of arms?"
"Up-to-date machine guns. Pickup trucks. All new and plentiful."
"Who was funding them? Do you know?" Cartwright tried to cough, but couldn't summon the strength to clear his throat fully. Malcolm could see how it hurt him, and said, "Take your time." He was aware that Bud behind him had turned to talk to the nurse, but his attention was focused on Cartwright, who was gesturing, asking for help to sit up. Malcolm put his arm around the man's back to lift him up, feeling how hot he was and how light. And again Cartwright tried to cough, racked with wheezing, hacking efforts that seemed to strain his very skeleton. Malcolm half turned round to ask Bud or the nurse to bring another pillow or a cushion. There was no one there. "Bud?" he said. Then he realized that Bud was there, on the floor, unconscious, his owl demon lying on his chest. The nurse had vanished. He let Cartwright down gently and darted to Bud, and saw a syringe next to him on the carpet. An empty vial lay on the table. Malcolm flung open the door and ran to the stairs. The nurse was already at the bottom, and she turned to look up at him, and there was a pistol in her hand. He hadn't noticed how young she was. "Mal!" began Asta, but she fired. Malcolm felt a crippling blow, but couldn't tell where he'd been hit, and he fell at once and slid tumbling down the stairs to lie half-stunned at the foot where the nurse had been standing a moment before. He pushed himself up, and then saw what she was doing. "No! Don't do it!" he cried, and tried to scramble over to her. She was standing inside the front door, holding the pistol under her chin. Her nightingale demon was shrieking with fear and fluttering at her face, but her eyes were clear and wide and blazing with righteousness. Then she pulled the trigger. Blood, bone, and brain exploded against the door, the wall, the ceiling. Malcolm sank to the floor. A crowd of sensations was gathering around him, among which he could smell yesterday's cooking and see sunlight glowing on the blood against the faded green paint of the door, and hear a ringing in his ears from the gunshot, and the distant howling of wild dogs, and a liquid trickle from the nurse's blood as the last pulsing of her heart forced it out of her shattered head, and the soft voice of his demon whispering next to him. And pain. There it was. A throb of it. Then another. And another. And then one long, deep, focused and brutal assault on his right hip. He felt it, and found his hand wet with blood. It was soon going to hurt a lot more, but there was Bud to see to. Could he get back up the stairs? He didn't try to stand, but hauled himself across the wooden floor, and then up, step by step, with his arms and his left leg.
"Mal, don't force it," said Asta faintly. "You're bleeding a lot."
"See if Bud's all right. That's all." He managed to stand up on the landing, and made it into the sick room. Bud was still lying, unconscious, but he was breathing clearly. Malcolm turned to Cartwright, and had to sit down on the edge of the bed. His leg was rapidly stiffening.
"Help me up,"
Cartwright whispered, and Malcolm tried to pull him upright with some difficulty, and leaned him against the headboard. His demon fell clumsily on his shoulder.
"The nurse,"
Malcolm began, but Cartwright shook his head, which set off another bout of coughing.
"Too late," he managed to say. "She's paid by them too. She's been giving me drugs, making me talk. And just now, poison."
"Being paid? What do you mean by the men from the mountains?" Malcolm was baffled.
"No, no, no. Them too. All part of the big medical..."
More coughing, and retching too. A dribble of bile left his lips and fell from his chin. Malcolm mopped it with a sheet and said quietly, urgently,
"The big medical. TP.
It meant nothing to Malcolm. "TP, he repeated.
Funding. TP. Company lettering on their trucks."
Cartwright's eyes closed. His chest heaved, the breath rattling in his throat. Then his entire body clenched and relaxed, and he was dead. His demon drifted into invisible particles and melted into the air. Malcolm felt the strength drain out of his body as the pain in his hip grew more insistent. He should look at the wound. He should attend to Schlesinger. He should report to Oakley Street. He had never felt the desire to go to sleep so powerful and urgent.
"Asta, keep me awake," he said.
"Malcolm, is that you?"
came in a blurred voice from the floor.
"Bud, you okay?"
"What happened?"
Schlesinger's demon was standing groggily and stretching her wings as Bud struggled to sit up.
"The nurse drugged you. Cartwright's dead. She was drugging him."
"What the hell?
Malcolm, you're bleeding. Stay there. Don't move.
She injected you with something while I had my back turned. Then she ran downstairs and I ran after her like a fool and she shot me before killing herself." Bud was holding on to the end of the bed. Whatever drug the nurse had injected into him was short-acting, because Malcolm could see the clarity returning to his friend's face second by second. He was looking at Malcolm's blood-soaked trouser leg.
"All right," he said. "First thing we do is get you out of here and call a doctor. We'll go out the back way through the bazaar. Can you walk at all?"
"Stiffly and slowly. You'll have to help me."
Bud stood up and shook his head to clear it.
"Okay, come on then," he said. "Oh, here. Put this on, it'll hide the blood."
He opened a wardrobe and took out a long raincoat and helped Malcolm put it on.
"Ready when you are,"
Malcolm said. A couple of hours later, after a doctor Bud trusted had examined and dressed Malcolm's wound, they sat with Anita drinking tea in the consulate, where they were staying while their apartment was being rebuilt.
"What did the doctor say?" said Anita.
"A bullet clipped the hip bone, but didn't break it. Could have been much worse."
"Does it hurt?"
"Yes, a lot. But you gave me some painkillers. Now, tell me about Lyra."
"I'm not sure you'd recognize her now. She's got short black hair and glasses."
Malcolm tried to imagine this dark-haired girl wearing glasses, without success.
"Could anyone have followed her to your apartment?" he said.
"You mean, was that why they bonded?" said Bud. "Because they thought she was there? I doubt it. In the first place, we weren't followed when we left the cafe. In the second place, they know where I live anyway. There's no secret about that. For the most part, the agencies leave each other alone, apart from the usual Secret Service attentions. Bombing, arson, they're not the local style. I'm worried about what happened to her after she took the train to Seleucia. What was she going to do there? Did she tell you? Well, she had a strange idea. It's the kind of thing anyone might think was crazy, but somehow, as she spoke about it, in the desert between Aleppo and Seleucia, there were dozens, maybe hundreds of empty towns and villages. Dead towns, that's what they call them. Nothing there but stones and lizards and snakes. And in one of those dead cities, well, this is what they say. Demons live there. Just demons. Lyra heard a story about it, oh, way back in England from some old guy on a boat. And she met an old woman here in Smyrna called Princess Cantacuzino, who told her about it as well. Lyra was going to go there and look for a demon. You don't sound as if you believe it. Schlesinger drank some of his tea and then said, Well, I had no idea, but the princess is an interesting woman. There was a huge scandal about her years ago. If she ever writes her memoirs, there's a bestseller in it. Anyway, her demon had left her like Lyra's had. If Lyra gets as far as Seleucia, what do you mean, if she gets that far? I mean, these are bad times, Mel. You've seen the numbers of people fleeing from the trouble further east. The Turks have been mobilizing their army in response. They expect trouble, and so do I. That young woman's moving right into the thick of it. And, as I say, if she makes it to Seleucia, she'll still have to travel on somehow to this Blue Hotel. What'll you do when you find her? Travel together. We're going further east, to where the roses come from. On behalf of Oakley Street. Well, yes, of course. Don't try and tell us that's all it is, said Anita. You're in love with her. Malcolm felt a great weariness oppress his heart. It must have shown in his expression because she went on, Sorry, ignore that. None of my business. One day I'll write my memoirs. But listen. Before he died, Cartwright said something about the men from the mountains who attacked the research station. He said they were funded by something called TP. Ever heard of that? Bud blew out his cheeks. Thuringia Petroleum, he said. Bad guys. Potash, said Anita. Not petroleum. Damn, that's right. Potash. Anita wrote a piece about them. It wasn't published, Anita continued. The editor was nervous about it. It's a very old company. They've been digging up potash in Thuringia for centuries. They used to supply companies that made fertilizer, explosives, chemical stuff generally. But about 20 years ago, TP began to diversify into manufacturing as well, because that's where the profit was. Arms and pharmaceuticals, mainly. They're enormous, Malcolm. And they used to loathe publicity. But markets don't work like that, and they're having to adapt to new ways of doing things. They had a big success with a painkiller called Treptazam, made a lot of money, and put it all into research. They're privately owned, no shareholders demanding dividends, and they've got good scientists. What are you looking at? Malcolm had reached uncomfortably into his pocket to take out a little bottle of pills. Treptazam, he read. There you are, said Bud. The name of every product they make contains the letters T and P. And Cartwright thought they were funding the terrorists, the men from the mountains. He saw the initials on the trucks they came in. They're after the roses. Of course they are. That explains a lot. Anita, could I see that story of yours? I'd like to read about the background. She shook her head. Most of my files went up at the apartment, she said. All that work. But could that have been the reason for bombing the place? She looked at Bud. He nodded reluctantly. One of them, he said. I'm so sorry. But for now, I'd better follow Lyra's trail. I told Lyra to seek out a guy in Aleppo called Mustafa Bey. He's a merchant. He knows everyone and everything. It's likely that she'll go to him first if she gets there. I would. Anyway, you'll find him at Marletto's Cafe. Bud bought Malcolm some clothes to replace the blood-soaked ones, and a stick to help him walk, and went with him to the railway station, where he was going to take the express for Aleppo. What'll you do with the safe house? Malcolm asked. Well, the police are there already. Someone reported the sound of the shots. We got out just in time, but we won't be able to use it again. It'll all be in my report to Oakley Street. Thanks, Bud. I owe you a lot. Say hello to Lyra, if... I'll do that.
As the train left,
Malcolm settled himself painfully in the air-conditioned comfort and took out the battered copy of Jahan and Roxana from Hassel's rucksack in an attempt to take his mind off the pain in his hip. The poem told the story of two lovers and their attempts to defeat Roxana's uncle, the sorcerer Kurash, and gain possession of a garden where precious roses grew. It was highly episodic. The story had many turns and byways, and brought in every kind of fabulous creature and outlandish situation. At one point, Jahan had to harness a winged horse and fly to the moon to rescue Roxana, who had been imprisoned by the Queen of the Night. And at another, Roxana used a forbidden amulet to overcome the threats of the fire fiend Razvani, and further elaborations followed each adventure, like little vortices of consequence spinning away from the main flow. In Malcolm's view, the story was almost insufferable, but the whole thing was redeemed by the poet's rapturous descriptions of the rose garden itself, and the physical world as a whole, and of the pleasures of the senses that were enjoyed by those who reached it in a state of knowledge.
"Either it means something," Malcolm said to Asta, "or it means nothing."
"My bet is on something," she said.
They were alone in the compartment. The train was due to stop in an hour's time.
"Why?" he said.
"Because Hassel wouldn't have burdened himself with it unless it meant something."
"Well, maybe it only meant something close and personal to him, and there's no other significance."
"But we need to know about him. It's important to know why he valued that poem."
"Maybe it's not the poem so much as this particular book, this edition, even this copy.
As a code book.
Something like that."
If two people each had a copy of the same book, they could send messages to each other by looking for the word they wanted and writing the page number, the line number, and the number of the word in the line, and if the book was unknown to anyone else, the code was practically unbreakable. Alternatively, the particular copy could itself carry a message if the letters or words wanted were indicated in some way by a pencil dot or something similar. The trouble with that method was that the message was equally readable by the enemy if it fell into their hands. It was hardly secret at all. Malcolm had spent some time looking for such marks, and several times had thought he'd found some, only to conclude that they were flaws in the cheap, coarse paper, rather than anything intended.
"Delamere is Lyra's uncle," said Asta.
"So what?"
Sometimes he could be very slow.
"Kurash is Roxana's uncle. He's trying to capture a rose garden."
"Oh, I see.
Who's Jahan?"
"Oh, really, Mal?
They're lovers. It's the essence of the situation that matters."
"It's a coincidence."
"Well," she said, "if you say so. But you were looking for a reason to find this book important."
"No, I already think it's important. I was looking for a good reason why. An accidental coincidence or two is just not convincing.
On its own, but when there are lots of them..."
"You're playing devil's advocate."
"There's a good reason for the devil's advocate. You have to be skeptical."
"I thought you were being credulous."
They were fencing. They often did, with him arguing X and her arguing Y, and then in a flash they'd change sides and argue the opposite, and eventually something would emerge that made sense to them both.
"That place she's looking for," Asta said, "that dead town, why do you think demons live there? Is there somewhere like that in the poem?"
"Damn it, actually there is. Roxana's shadow is stolen, and she has to get it back from the land of the Zargles."
"Who are they?"
"Devils who eat shadows."
"Does she get it back?"
"Yes, but not without sacrificing something else." They sat in silence for a while.
"And I suppose," he began.
"What?" "There's a passage in which Roxana is captured by the enchantress Shazada, the Queen of the Night, and Jahan rescues her."
"Go on."
"The thing is that he tricks her by tying her silk sash in a clever knot that she can't undo. And while she's trying to do that, he and Roxana escape."
He waited. Then she said,
"Oh, the fairy of the Thames, and the box she couldn't open."
"Diania, yes, the same kind of thing."
"Al, this is..."
"Very similar. I can't deny that."
"But what does it mean, for things like that to turn up? It might be just a matter of temperament whether you find it meaningful.
Well, that would make it meaningless, he pointed out. Shouldn't it be true whether you believe in it or not?
Maybe refusing to see is the mistake. Maybe we should make a commitment. Decide. What happens at the end of the poem?
They find the garden, and defeat the sorcerer, and get married.
And live happily ever after. Mal, what are we going to do? Believe it or not? Does it mean what it seems to mean? And what does mean anyway?
Well, that's easier, he said. The meaning of something is its connection to something else. Or to us, in particular. The train was slowing down as it moved through the outskirts of a town on the coast.
It wasn't going to stop here, was it? Said Asta.
No. It might just be slowing down because they're working on the next track or something. But it wasn't that. The train slowed down even further and entered the station at a crawl. In the fading afternoon light, Malcolm and Asta could see a dozen or so men and women gathered around a platform from which someone had been giving a speech, or perhaps saying a ceremonial farewell. A man in a dark suit and a wing-collared shirt was stepping down. Hands were being shaken, embraces bestowed. Clearly he was someone important enough for the railway company to change their schedules for. A porter in the background picked up two suitcases and came to put them on the train. Malcolm tried to move because his leg was stiffening, but the pain was relentless. He couldn't even stand up.
Lie down, said Asta.
The train began to move once more, and Malcolm felt a great resignation settle over him like falling snow. The strength was draining out of him minute by minute. Maybe he'd never move again. His body was failing, and the sensation drew him back 20 years to that dreadful mausoleum in the flood, where he'd had to go to the very edge of his strength to save Alice from Gerard Bonneville. Alice would know what to do now. He whispered her name, and Asta heard and tried to respond, but she was dazed with pain as well. And when he fainted, so did she. The ticket inspector found her unconscious on his breast. A pool of blood was gathering on the floor. Chapter 30 Norman and Barry. Alice Lonsdale was sorting out some linen, putting aside those sheets and pillowcases that could be mended, and tearing up for dusters and cleaning rags those beyond help, when Mr. Corson, the steward, opened the door and came in.
"Alice," he said, "the master wants to see you."
He looked serious, but then he never looked light-hearted.
"What's he want me for?" said Alice. "He's seeing all of us. Collections for servants, I expect."
Collections was the term for an annual meeting between student and tutor, at which the student's progress was assessed.
"Has he seen you yet?" said Alice, hanging up her apron.
"Not yet. You heard anything from young Lyra?"
"No, and I'm worried sick, I don't mind saying.
She seems to have vanished off the face of the earth.
The master's in the bursar's office, because they're redecorating his."
Alice had no particular anxiety about seeing the master, though she had never cared for him, and since hearing how he treated Lyra, she detested him thoroughly. She knew she did her job well, and had enlarged the duties she'd originally been engaged to carry out to such an extent that in the bursar's view, and in the steward's, and certainly in that of the old master too, she was essential to the smooth running of the college. In fact, two or three other colleges had taken the revolutionary step of appointing housekeepers of their own, in imitation, thus breaking a centuries-old Oxford habit of employing only male senior servants. So she was confident that whatever Dr. Hammond wanted to see her about, it wouldn't be dissatisfaction with her work. In any case, that would have been a matter for the domestic bursar, not the master. Curious. She knocked on the door of the bursar's secretary, Janet, and went in. Janet's demon, a squirrel, immediately scampered across to greet Ben, Alice's demon, and Alice felt a little shiver of apprehension, without knowing why. Janet, a slight, pretty woman, in her 30s, was looking anxious, and kept glancing at the bursar's office door. She put her finger to her lips. Alice came closer.
"What's going on?" she said quietly.
Janet whispered,
"He's got a couple of men with him, from the CCD.
He hasn't said they are, but you can tell.
Who else has he seen?
No one.
I thought he was seeing all the servants.
No, that's what he told me to tell Mr. Corson. Alice, do be—
The office door opened. The master stood there himself, with a bland smile of welcome.
Mrs. Lonsdale, he said, thank you so much for coming. Janet, could we have some coffee?
Of course, sir,
she said, more startled than Alice, more nervous.
Do come in, said Dr. Hammond. I hope I'm not disturbing your work, but I thought we might have a chat.
Alice went in as he held the door. There were two men in there with him, as Janet had said, both seated. Neither of them stood up or smiled or offered to shake hands. Alice could project a beam, that was how she thought of it, of intense coldness when she wanted to, and she did then. The men didn't move or change their expressions, but she knew the beam had reached its target. She sat down in the third chair in front of the desk, between the two.